Hey, a quick programming note, bedheads. Unlike most episodes of this show, this one is actually kind of timely because we're going to reference the Jane's Addiction on stage fight. And between the time that we recorded the episode and it goes up on the feed, more things have happened around that situation that obviously will not get referenced here. So just in case you're listening and you're like, why didn't they say about the tour getting canceled, et cetera, et cetera? Well, it hadn't happened yet. Okay, got it? Boom. Let's do it.
Don't go to sleep, motherfucker. Don't go to sleep.
And do me a favor. Don't disturb my friend. He's dead tired.
Well, what the hell are you saying, Doss? You bruised half your body sleeping.
I sleep pretty hard.
Welcome to Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories.
Hey, it's Brian.
And hey, it's Murdoch. Welcome to Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories.
Sometimes it's your letters that drive this show. You send those to wearethestoryguys@gmail.com.
And sometimes it's the headlines that drive our...
And that particular headline this week is...
Jane's Addiction concert ends abruptly after Perry Farrell throws a punch at Dave Navarro is forced off stage by crew.
It sort of says it all.
Yeah, and if you've been watching this reunion tour... It sort of seems like it's a bummer. And here's my take, and I'm a hot take. And I'm assuming some people might not like this. So what an influential band. And what an influential guy who started an unbelievably
amazing music festival.
The cultural impact that Lollapalooza had in America. I mean, it created Homerpalooza, which people got to see. And people understood, younger people understood what it was all about. But I always thought he kind of sang like a flea, if a flea could sing. So
Wait. Stop. Yeah. What? Explain what you mean by that.
I'm saying if a flea...
Like a flea on a dog, if it had a singing voice.
Yeah, if a flea...
It would sound like Perry Farrell.
Right, if a flea was in an alternative band, it would front... Jane's Addiction. Also, he used to be a gigolo. I don't know if you knew that when he was younger.
This is true?
Yeah.
A male prostitute?
Yep.
I did not know this.
He was a gigolo. So I saw him years...
Is this like a real thing or is this just the thing he says in interviews?
It's a thing I've read. There's a thing. I mean, he's older, but... So I saw him maybe 2008, 2009, and it was like Perry Farrell and Friends.
Uh-huh.
And he had the bottle of wine.
Yeah.
And the wife...
So that's the phrase I keep seeing.
Is the bottle of wine.
Is sipping from a full bottle of wine. There was in multiple reports that I read.
Right.
And I said this to my wife, and she goes, one bottle of wine? What a lightweight.
Yeah, what a lightweight. Yeah.
You need at least two, right? You need a Chirac.
But his life has been around... I mean, God, it's awful. It's in the name of his band. Like, he's had to fight... drugs and alcohol and addiction like his entire life, and it's been in there. And like, I saw him playing in a very fun concert where he was drinking out of a bottle of wine and making out with his wife the whole time, and I was like, well, this is good fun. I mean, it was.
But so I've never seen Jane's,
and this tour his voice is gone, and like it's like words, no words,
right? So I read that the Chicago shows have been weird. Or no, not Chicago, New York. He did two shows in New York. One of them, the band was basically disowning. And then they were like, we'll come back and tomorrow will be better. And then there were some reviews saying that the second night was better. So he's been intermittent, but the quality of his voice is not there. And, you know, according to Murdoch, he sounded like a flea to begin with. So it really, your mileage may vary on what you enjoy.
And his wife, I don't know if she deleted it, but his wife had an Instagram post and blamed a lot of this on tinnitus and having a sore throat.
Just like him sounding bad in general or him punching?
Right. And being frustrated. And then I saw the devil's advocate was someone saying, well, it's the sound engineer has the mix set up in the inner ear and in the monitor so he can't hear himself, so he can't hear what he sounds like because they put him down in the mix because he doesn't sound good. Like, that was just a thing that they were saying.
So I've seen him once by accident, so I never purposely... The funny thing about this whole thing, and I think I may have told you this, is that the day before this story broke, I happened to get a promotional email from a venue that was like, hey, we got deals on Jane's Addiction tickets, and I was like, yeah, no... Navarro's back. That might be interesting. If a cheap ticket, a short drive, I might go. Like, eh, probably not, but I might go see it. And then the next day, these headlines broke. And the only time I've seen him before was 2014 Lollapalooza. He just had, like, at that point, and I don't know if he does this at all anymore at Lollapalooza, but at that point, he just, like, had time booked where he just walked around. Like, I think they just played music. Like, I don't know if he was technically DJing, but it was, like, 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and Perry Farrell's just on this stage being like, yeah! You know, because it's his party. He can do whatever he wants. But I've never seen one of his bands.
And so, you know, Dave had long COVID, and that's why he disappeared. Dave Navarro had, like, Dave Navarro disappeared from all of our radar.
I did not know that.
He had long COVID, and it really affected his health.
Listen, he's getting a lot of coverage on this show. We just talked about NXS Rockstar.
And in addition to long COVID, he had recorded a record which was in the tank.
A solo record?
No, it was a supergroup record, and the drummer was fucking Taylor Hawkins. So he had long COVID, and then he was friends with Taylor Hawkins, and you don't get that story about he's friends with Taylor Hawkins because he's not in the Foo Fighters having an extramarital affair and having a baby, because it's not it's not headlines.
I got another confession to make. Yes, palm mute. I do actually. I have an actual confession to make.
But we're not here to talk about the flea that fronts Jane's Addiction.
Oh my God.
That was just the headlines.
Dude. Well, let's talk about the situation for a second. In case you have not paid attention to this, I joke all the time with my wife about how our algorithms are different. So this was everywhere for me yesterday.
Same.
And I say everywhere like it was on social media, but I mean, because of who we hang out with and who we are, it's like in my text messages, right? Like people just want to have conversations. So you and I are having conversations about it. There are conversations.
Variety ran a piece about it.
Yeah, it was big news yesterday. If you're a rock fan and if you listen to this show, you probably this has run across your radar. So just real quickly, basically what happens, right, is that they're on stage. They're in like song, what, 11 of 14, something like that.
So Ocean Size?
Yeah, so it's the back half of the show. You can see the video because tons of people got it and put it up on the internet. And Perry's getting frustrated. He starts like making, like barking, not in the mic.
And he says, "Fuck you, fuck you.
You're cool, I'm out."
And he just starts yelling.
He starts quoting half-baked.
And then he's
just a big misunderstanding. I was doing my Dave Chappelle impression.
He shoulder checks Dave Navarro. And
Dave is playing. He has to stop playing and put his hand out to distance himself from Perry.
Yeah, and to stop. Perry punches at him.
And then he swings at his face.
So that's the headline.
Does he make contact?
No.
Okay, so he swings at his face, but the assumption is he's very drunk. He's very frustrated. Maybe it is because of a bad mix or tinnitus or tons of other things. But his inhibitions are gone. Dave seems to be the bigger guy here. It seems like Dave's just trying to do his job. There's been stuff leading up to this, not only the quality of the shows, but there's been a couple other incidences where, like, Perry is rambling on the mic.
They cut the house lights, and then the sound. Show's over. And there's three people that get Perry to take him off stage. One of those people is Eric Avery, the bass player. Perry's wife alleges, I can't say yes or no, that Eric Avery came over and put him in a headlock, which it does look like someone comes over to aggressively get him and then punches him in the stomach three times.
Oh.
So that's drama.
It's really bad when the whole band is like, mm-mm, you're out, dude. I know this is your operation, but no. So they then come back. So everybody but Perry comes out, basically takes a bow together.
With no house lights.
And so I saw somebody who was at the show say, you know, as we were walking out, there were two reactions. One is, oh man, I got gypped. I didn't get the end of the show. So I'm sure they didn't get whatever the big hit is that they're doing at the end of the show. I don't know what that is. Maybe Van Caught Stealing or something. And then, but the other one was like, the other half of the crowd was like, cool, we probably saw the last Jane's Addiction show ever.
Yeah, there's an apology from the band yesterday, and they canceled last night.
But they haven't canceled these other shows yet.
Right.
So we could go see that regional show.
No. No. Not gonna go.
I also saw that this was co-headlining with Love and Rockets, and I'm like, are those guys on the same level, Jane's Addiction and Love and Rockets?
I'd love to go see Love and Rockets, but I can't.
Telling you, cheap tickets.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking like $20 tickets, the email I got. You know, corporate concert world. They're just trying to get people in there.
Yeah.
Well, maybe now they won't have the problem. Maybe people will go see if it, you know. I don't know if this hurts or helps. A lot of times this sort of thing helps.
Gosh, not now.
I don't know. So, I mean, knowing that he doesn't sound good, I don't think that helps. But, okay, so here's the whole thing. We're talking about this because immediately when this news broke, I knew that it was time to take on this an episode that I have been actively threatening to do, and I just hadn't sat down to really to hammer out. And it feels like this is the right time to do it. Way back on an episode that we did about Sublime, that was episode 161, we mentioned that Sublime has like a few major influences. We talked about Fishbone, we talked about Bad Brains, and then the third influence in that cocktail is the Butthole Surfers.
You know how people go and they see where they are now, like people that did, they were photographs that were memes.
Yeah.
Like at the beginning
of that.
I'd like to see 10 or 15 years from now, like post-COVID, essentially, like what happened to the girl, the little girl with the ukulele that's singing the song that's, I wonder what's inside of your butthole? That's what I want to see. Anyway.
I was like, where are we going with this? But yes, that was a big hit in my house. That got heavy rotation.
To the degree that they go get Paul Leary, who...
Yeah, Sublime.
Sublime does. He's the Surfers guitar player to produce that landmark first record. That's how much the Butthole Surfers
were. So even if you've never listened to the Butthole Surfers, I guarantee you know at least the work of Paul Leary, because he'll go on to produce things like this, which obviously were huge and are huge to a lot of... We hear a lot about that Sublime episode, right? Because there's a lot of people who that really affected. So on that episode, I believe one of us mentioned the book Our Band Could Be Your Life by Michael Azarod. This is the equivalent of I Want My MTV or Live from New York, that SNL oral history, in terms of being one of the like backbone core texts of an entire scene. And it's maybe one of the earliest rock histories that I ever sat down and read that like wasn't about the Beatles or wasn't just liner notes.
Yeah.
This book has been around for a quarter of a century. Did you read this? Were you into this book?
Yeah, yeah.
I remember sitting in a college bookstore. I worked in the bookstore at my college. And I remember squirreling away some time either on a break or maybe I was hiding in the stack somewhere. And finding this and thumbing through it and just being in awe, because it was the first long form journalism I'd ever seen about some of these bands.
Right. The subtitle of the book, by the way, is Scenes for the American Indie Underground, 1981 to 1991. Each chapter has a different band, and that's what's fun. So it's the chapters of Sonic Youth, Husker Du, Minor Threat, Fugazi, Mudhoney, and then chapter 8 is reserved for What's Inside Your Butthole, the Butthole Surfers.
And it contains possibly the crazy band member meltdown story that I have ever heard. It will put the Dave and Perry stuff to absolute shame. But before we get to that, let's just do some background on this band. Will you just go ahead and read the opening paragraph to chapter 8 from that book? This is like the perfect setup.
Yeah, here's the setup for the Butthole Surfers, if you're not familiar. The Butthole Surfers really seem like they were from another planet. Upon first hearing, their music inspired the nearly universal reaction, "What the hell is this?" It was creepy and dark and ugly and weird. Admitting you liked it would probably lose you some friends. And that was nothing compared to their live shows, depraved acid hallucinations of transgression and horror that were often physically dangerous to the band and audience alike.
Shouts to Michael Azarod. Do you know the other book that he's famous for besides this one?
What is it?
The 93 Nirvana book.
Oh.
Come As You Are.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. And I own it, and I saw his name in my head.
So the history of this band, Butthole Surfers, is really tied to the relationship between two dudes. So like other people come in and out of the band, right? And very interesting people come in and out of the band. But it's really about Paul Leary, who we already mentioned, and a guy named Gibby Haynes. And in the 70s, they find each other at Trinity University, of all places, in San Antonio, Texas. And one of the main things they have in common is that they both like weird music.
But they are pursuing traditional careers. And those of you who are familiar with Gibby Haynes and have not heard this next fact, this is real. Gibby Haynes becomes an accountant after being the captain of the basketball team and graduating with honors.
But despite these normie accomplishments, Paul describes Gibby as always being, quote, the weirdest guy at school. And one of the fun things that you always read, again, we're going to talk about how much lore there is around this band. You'll always read this, is that basically their first partnership is that while they're maybe one of them is still in school, they start publishing this fanzine fanzine that they call Strange VD.
Yes. Here is Strange VD in a nutshell. They track down the most horrendous medical photographs they can find, and then they would caption them with made-up disease names like taco leg or pine cone butt. And I want everyone to understand who is younger than me in a different generation or who didn't have an Atari or didn't grow up with a computer. Before you could be your own publisher in the 90s, they made zines, and this is the kind of shit that we would do. Make up VDs and make a zine that you would make it work from the copier.
Well, it's highbrow stuff. And to your point, you have to print it.
And that shit was expensive. You didn't want to go to Kinko's.
So guess what they do? They go to Gibby's workplace, which is an accounting firm.
Right. Which is a great place.
They sneak in, they use the copier, and one day they accidentally leave a photo behind. And that photo is of some mutilated genitalia. And gotta say, that kind of ends the whole thing for them.
Yeah, so Gibby, by leaving behind a picture of taco leg or pine cone butt, whatever it is he left on the copier, that's pretty much it. So those two weirdo goofballs find this is a great time to move to Southern California where they make money making t-shirts with Lee Harvey Oswald's face on them to sell at the beach, which Brian and I did for a couple months until we gave it up because we thought, Patsy.
So, this is, again, this is lore. Like, this is the thing you got to understand about the surfers, is there's so much lore, including the story we're going to talk about today. And yes, I think that most of it is true, but they've really learned how to talk about themselves. They kind of mastered this to create this whole package of craziness. And this is the quote from Paul Leary about selling t-shirts. And I did read in some quote that there were also beach towels involved since they were on the beach. So you could get a Lee Harvey Oswald beach towel.
I wonder if it was the Lee Harvey Oswald Photoshop thing where he's in the band and they put the microphone in front of his face.
I did wonder which picture it was. I Googled because I was like, Lee Harvey Oswald's face doesn't come to mind when I think about Notorious Folks.
And there was a band that took that and they were like the Lee Harvey Oswald something.
Oh, that's right. I forgot about that band.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is the quote from Paul Leary about this period of their lives. Quote, then we just decided that making t-shirts with Lee Harvey Oswald's face on them, was too much work and thought maybe music would be easier. So we started a band.
Great quote. And if you believe that their reason to enter music was really that pragmatic, it may help explain why what they the offer is less music and that it's intense and a weird experience and how that is.
They go back to San Antonio, and Leary describes their live performance debut in an art gallery this way, another quote. It was more of a performance piece than a musical piece. It involved lots of stuffed dummies, toasters, Big Mac hamburgers and things. We played music, and Gibby ran around with a piece of meat hanging out of his mouth.
Yes, and that's great. The bit at first is that they change their name at every gig.
This is a pretty good bit. So if you don't want any longevity, it's a great bit.
Vodka Family Winstons, that's one. 9-inch Worm Makes Own Food. Ashtray Baby Heads, which, by the way, became a real band.
I was going to say, that's a real band. That's a real band. I'm pretty sure I had an Ashtray Babyheads record at some point.
Or they opened for Super Drag or something.
I can remember the album art, so we'll have to look that up.
Yeah.
Those are all names they perform under. Right. And one night, the MC is introducing them, and they played in this venue a couple times. They have a song called Butthole Surfers at the time, and so he just calls them. He gets confused. I don't know, something. He calls them Butthole Surfers, and they're like, okay, that's good. We'll stick with that.
Yeah, and you can imagine in Texas, this type of performing doesn't draw huge crowds in the middle of Texas. It's just like the Sex Pistols, like coming across Texas in the late 70s.
Yeah, nope.
They won't even put their full band name in most places. They become the BH Surfers. Did we talk about the Rude Street Peters, my favorite redneck band from college?
Oh, we have before, but refresh.
So they would get banned because there'd be fights. And their songs were... Their drummer didn't have a thing that he sat on. He sat on a bucket, and he had a snare and a cymbal. Got it? Okay. The guitar player, like the bass player, had three strings. That bass, by the way, John Davis from Superdrag owns that bass. It was his cousin's. And then, like, everything was ridiculous. And all the songs were nuts. There was one song that started off, and it said, I've been to five world fairs. I've seen a shark eat a helicopter. Like, none of it made any fucking sense.
That's
but people,
a cool line,
people would fight, and so they would change their name. So,
oh, you're right. You have talked about
so
this.
So they would be the Rude Street Chili Peppers, or the Rude Street Chili Peckers, or the Red Hot, you know,
so,
Chili
so that Peters. They could keep getting booked.
That's correct, yeah.
Oh, that's really funny.
Yeah.
That's really funny. Okay, so they truck back to California after all of this, and they take this van that barely works. They barely get there. And there's this other great story, again, talking about the lore, that they take this van and they pull up in front of this venue in San Francisco.
Yeah. The too long didn't read of this story is, since they barely make it there, they're told they aren't in the bill, so they beg to play three songs.
And it is at this three-song set, supposedly, that Jello Biafra is in the audience. And that is a man who has gotten his own episode of this show. He is the lead singer of the Dead Kennedys, of course. This is where he will see the BH Surfers for the first time. And he will just decide, you know, this seems like a great band to open for Dead Kennedys.
Yeah. With this help from Jello and his label Alternative Tentacles, that helps a lot. And eventually they become a big part of Touch and Go, which is a huge influential label Chicago.
Yep.
But fast forward and get us to where we are going, just to know that these guys, while not really playing punk music, live a punk lifestyle.
Yeah, this is Gibby and Leary in an interview from early on, where they're both talking, and Gibby says, "It seems like everywhere we play, we insult people and make them regret having us there." And then Paul chimes in and says, "Takes them about 6 months to forget, so then we come back."
That's so good. It's essential for our story to understand that this band is always about shock and performance art. Always. That's part of the deal. So let me read from their chapter in Our Band Could Be Your Life, an attempt to help the non-initiated grasp what the Butthole Surfers shows are like.
This is unbelievable.
Yeah. So this is Gibby Haynes has taken to making his stage entrance with a dummy duct tape to his body so it looked like he was dancing with it. Then he'd tear it off and start attacking it. He'd sing through a megaphone, which... Who has ripped that off?
Everyone.
Everyone?
Everyone has ripped that off.
An idea that was stolen... over the next 10 years. Often he'd wear several layers of dresses and peel them off one by one until the end of the show.
That's good. That's a good bit.
He was down to his skivvies. He'd stuff his clothes with condoms filled with fake blood. So when he'd fall on the floor, he'd turn into a gory mess. He'd hurl reams of photocopied pictures of cockroaches into the crowd. He'd pour a flammable liquid into an inverted cymbal, then whack it, which I've seen a lot, sending up a geyser of flame.
Oh, that is not safe. No. But that is a real handyman way of having pyro at your show. Just take note.
Usually set his hands on fire. There was a time he made his entrance through a hole he'd cut in a mattress covered in fake blood. Often the whole band would rip apart stuffed animals on stage like a frenzied pack of psychotic cannibals. It was just madness as coffee. It was just the more the merrier.
Now, obviously, all this stuff is pre-internet. So now you and I would have watched this on YouTube and it all would have worn off, right? But then it's all word of mouth, so you have to get this chance to see it. If you're going to see it, you got to be in a room to see it. There's something else, too, about this band, though. Something that you are an expert on, I would like to talk about with you. Tape trading. Did you ever tape trade for surfer stuff?
Not specifically, but it's how I became familiar with all this.
Oh, okay.
Because I remember... What got my attention was seeing him with lighter fluid, pouring them on the cymbals and hitting the cymbals and seeing the flames and realizing I was watching a rock band. Because, like, well, that was kind of weird. And not understanding there was any music at all. It just seemed like it was...
This was like a VHS tape that you would get in the mail?
Yeah. Well, no, someone had it, and so I watched it, and then it was like... I didn't understand that the Butthole Surfers were a traditional rock band because they weren't.
Because they weren't. Yeah. I mean, especially at the beginning, they weren't.
So all I knew was that it was this weird shit out of Texas.
Well, and so your experience is exactly the same experience that a lot of guys in the scene have. There is a whole portion in this book where it's described that Ian MacKay will be passing that, like, he'll go from town to town and he'll have a tape of the BH Surfers that ends up, and I think that's how the guy from Touch and Go gets it initially, is through Ian. So, I mean, the tape trading aspect of this cannot be left out. It's important. So all of this is going to bring us to October 12th, 1985. That is where the key part of our story happens. And I will say, before we get into this specific day slash night slash performance, having just heard that description of what the regular shows were like, keep in mind, a mild night for the Surfers is a crazy, insane night for most bands. But part of the reason I like this particular story, I mean, I will say that I saw a list of the craziest Butthole Surfers performances or whatever, and this was like only 7 on a list of the top 10. Yeah. But I like this one because it's got some good guest stars.
Right. Speaking of guest stars on this evening and most evenings, we should acknowledge that these guys have a guest star that's called Drugs.
Not just any drug, let's be clear. Acid. During this period of the band, they were doing a lot of LSD, which kind of helps explain the whole situation.
Yeah. And then additionally, we have to explain how they get to the Netherlands for this performance.
Oh, yes. Which is the this best is part. Key. Thank you for reminding me of this. So we mentioned that the core is Paul and Gibby. Rest of the band, you know, folks coming in and out. Also, we haven't mentioned this. I just feel the need to mention this because you were mentioning the band that had the weird drum setup. They have 2 drummers for a while. You remember this early on?
Yeah.
And the whole thing is they just have 2 drummers. And they have to, like, when they have no money. And this chapter in this book really goes into this. They are so broke that they're, like, eating out of trash cans at certain periods of the band because they're just, like, art rock. And they are still trying to haul in small cars, like, 2 drum sets. It's not practical at all whatsoever. But anyway, all that to say that at some point in the mid-80s, they bring a guy into this band whose name is Mark Kramer.
Right. Also, by the way, who had 2 drum sets first, Butthole Surfers or the Melvins?
The Melvins and the Butthole Surfers have some... There is some overlap there, yeah. Especially later. They have shared members and such.
Right, but it's like, who came up with that?
Because J.D. Pincus is in both bands at some point, right?
That's right.
Yeah, okay.
So they like Mark Kramer because he had been in this other band that they vibe with called Shockabilly, which to me seemed like a whole like genre in the 90s.
I know, right?
Shockabilly had built up this fan base in Europe, so much so that they had a whole tour booked. And Mark Kramer, who joins the Surfers, he literally makes one phone call and gets the Surfers an entire European tour just by changing the featured act from his old band to his new band.
Which is wild.
Yeah.
So these guys who have been eating out of trash cans now are on a European tour because of this friend of theirs. And they're totally unknown over there, but they're getting on really good bills because they're using the equity of this other band, which is a key part of this story. So one of the things they get is this prime slot at a festival called the Pandora Festival that included Nick Cave and Echo and the Bunnymen, and a slew of other bands who were way more successful than the Surfers at this point.
Yes, and definitely Nick Cave and Echo and the Bunnymen, same genre of music as the Butthole Surfers. Remember when you said they like to do acid? This is a quote from Mark Kramer. It is firstly important to state that on this night, Gibby had eaten an entire handful of 4-way acid tabs and drank an entire bottle of Jim Beam before soundcheck had started.
All right, let's talk about acid. Do you know what blotter art is?
No, but I heard about it when I was in college, and I heard like something about blotto and it being acid or being blottoed. And
I did not know about this blotting paper. But, I mean, this is just me being naive, I guess, and not doing acid. Highly absorbent paper, blotter paper, right? And this is what you would use for literally like quill pens or fountain pens. In the 60s, though, people who are into acid figure out that because it's very absorbent and it can take all that ink, it can also take other liquids. So you could absorb LSD into it and then put it on your tongue and boom, you're in. So you buy these sheets of blotting paper with perforated squares. You drop a very particular dose size into each square. And then on the squares, you still multipurpose. You can still put art. So you might have a cartoon character or religious imagery or, you know, whatever it is. And that's like that dosage or that particular type of acid at that particular time becomes known by whatever the name is of that art, right? But the art then takes on a life of its own. By the 70s, this added dimension of the art, it gets its own underground appeal, and people just want to see the art and not even do the acid. It's a whole thing.
Yeah. Did you Google all this, by the way, church boy?
I did. I might get in trouble. Hey, okay. I also Googled, though, how long will the effects of a single tab last? Because, again, naive about acid.
Did you Google, am I going to die after I take acid? Why do I feel like I'm going to die after I take drugs?
Why can't I feel my face?
Yeah. Why am I dying?
Here's what I found on the Google machine. You may begin to feel the effects of one tab of acid within 20 to 90 minutes of ingesting the drug, although the average acid trip can last anywhere from 6 to 15 hours. Most won't last more than 12. Anyway, all that to say, Gibby took an entire handful of tabs before the sound check. What? Yeah. How many do you think that is?
Evel Knievel.
5, 10? Yeah.
It's Evel Knievel. So we talked about the root of the band being two guys. It's Gibby and Paul. And you know, close working relationships mm-hmm. like this can get mm-hmm. frustrating, right? As we started off the top of the show, especially if your partner is eating lysergic acid like it's Skittles or Reese's Pumpkins. Delicious this time of year.
Apparently, time comes for sound check, and Gibby is nowhere to be found. And Paul is mad because Paul understands the dynamic of what they have here with Mark Kramer and that Mark Kramer has put his reputation on the line for them. And so he's pissed because his buddy is going to screw this up for them. It's a big show. Gibby's gone. This is Leary's quote, Paul Leary's quote, according to Kramer.
Yes.
Quote, fuck that stupid motherfucker. I hate this fucking band. I hate this band more than I hate myself. And that is a lot. I don't care if we ever play again. If you can't find him, fuck it. And then Paul starts smashing guitars with his hands. Ouch.
Yeah. At this point, Kramer decides it probably should be him.
Listen, let me intervene. I don't think we should send you out looking for this guy, right?
I'm going to go look for Gibby.
And so keep in mind, this is a music festival, and so there's multiple stages. So Kramer starts walking around the grounds, and he walks over. He gets a little distracted. He sees Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds are on, and he's like, oh, I've always wanted to see these guys or whatever, right? So he's watching them, and then he realizes something weird's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a naked guy who keeps getting onto the stage and charging at the band members and then getting pushed off of the 10-foot high stage into the audience by security or by the guitar player, only to reemerge and try it again a few minutes later. And Kramer realizes, as this starts to happen again, oh crap, that is acid-tripping, alcohol-soaked Gibby.
And if you were listening to the podcast kind of passively, I'm going to get you back in. Gibby Haynes of the Butthole Surfers is tripping balls naked and hopping on the stage during a Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds set, getting kicked off the stage, going back and
back
doing
on
it
the
again.
Stage. This inspires another beatdown later. So Kramer finally gets to him after one of these particular falls and thinks he's non-responsive. But Azarod will describe in his book, quote, he's suddenly like a volcano. Gibby bursts to life and swirls his fists in every direction.
Yeah. This inspires yet another beatdown in the crowd again. And Gibby apparently gets knocked out only to wait until his attackers start walking away to push himself on his feet and to begin screaming obscenities and calling everyone names. He's not having a happy lysergic trip of
so read what Kramer describes happens next.
Yeah. And this is great. This is just fun rock and roll bedtime stories, right? The ensuing chase and capture was the stuff dreams are made of. Stark, naked, like the day he was born, Gibby Haynes, beaten, bruised, bloodied, and tripping. This icon of modern music ran like Jesse Owens through the entire complex, grabbing beer bottles from people's hands as he went and throwing them.
And when a group of people catch up to him this time, they will push him down and hold him down, and then he just starts yelling. And he says, I'm sorry, I have a brain tumor. And then he takes off to the surfer's dressing room and slams the door behind him.
So imagine you're this third guy who's just used up your old band's clout to get these two lunatics who make up your new band a high-profile gig. And now you're sitting outside the dressing room listening to them screaming at each other from behind a closed door.
And so Kramer finally gets the courage to open the door a little bit, right? And he says, he just opens the door. Picturing this is amazing. Two guys are just smashing everything. Guitars, bottles, chairs, just like total chaos, you name it. And then right in the middle of this chaos, pushing past our friend Kramer, comes a random guy into the dressing room like nothing is happening. And he just says, hey, fellas, can I borrow a guitar?
Yeah, this fucking story, guys. There's a naked, crazed Gibby Hain. He swings around and says, "Who the fuck are you?" And a totally unfazed guy goes, "Hi, I'm Alex Chilton. I'm Alex Chilton from Memphis, Tennessee, and I just came over for a European festival, and I didn't even bring any fucking gear. Hey, naked butthole surfers guy, do you have a guitar?"
This stops them dead in their tracks, according to Kramer, and they just look at each other because the guy from the Box Tops and Big Star is in their dressing room asking for a guitar, and he just goes, "Yeah, you can take whatever you want." And they turn and show him like the three things they haven't smashed yet. And I guess Alex Chilton takes one of them.
I wish that I had a time machine just for like 10 seconds.
Just 10. And people are like, what would you do if you could briefly, I want to go into this room, just briefly pop in, see this happen, and pop back out. Unbelievable stuff.
I found my autographed Alex Chilton CD this weekend, digging out of the box. So I'm glad we did this.
Timely. So the guys do finally make it on stage that night, surprisingly. But Gibby has kept drinking. So this phrase that we mentioned about, that shows up in all the news reports about Perry from this weekend, about full bottle of wine, sipping from a full bottle of wine, same phrase as in the Michael Azarod book about this performance. So after all of this, after all of the Jim Beam and the acid, whatever else is happening in Gibby's body, he's walking on stage with a full bottle of wine, and he just keeps drinking. He tries to jump into the crowd, and the crowd moves because they do not want any of that on them, and he will fall, knock himself out, and then wake up and start vomiting everywhere.
Yes, we can take a small break if we need to, everybody. It was a lot. I mean, we kind of took everybody like kind of to the mall real fast to get something, like when it's like Black Friday to buy something. We'll slow down a little bit. All right. So if you can imagine, after the show, Gibby is still intoxicated and will start yelling obscenities again. He forgets he has already been paid and starts demanding money, and repeats the earlier scene of getting chased around the festival grounds and starts throwing beer bottles again.
Okay, and so remember, I've said several times that this band is all about their own lore. And what's the most unbelievable part of this story, as unbelievable as pretty much all of it is that this immediately, not even with like time, immediately becomes part of the talking points about the how amazing the Butthole Surfers are. It somehow happens that the local paper in the Netherlands runs a story the next day highlighting the band as the best part of that freaking festival.
That's right.
So what I'm saying is the Perry Farrell, Dave Navarro stuff is amateur hour.
Yeah. And speaking of those two guys, the men who inspired us to finally do the episode, I'm going to connect the dots here on the two bands that got us here, the Butthole Surfers and Jane's Addiction.
You're going to connect the dots.
Years later, believe it or not, now that we have you sat through the story, the Butthole Surfers will have major labels fighting over them. And I remember when this happened.
Including Rick Rubin. Rick Rubin tries hard to get the Surfers.
And I just thought it was a fucking joke. Because I was like, "You're really going to try to make money off this band? All right." This is a quote from the Surfers' manager, Tom Bunch, talking about the show that gets them signed to Capitol. Hale Milgram, who was president of Capitol, came to see them in New York at the Marquee Club. There were probably 8 to 10 record label VPs or presidents there. The Jane's Addiction guys were there.
What?
Jane's Addiction managers. There were probably 30 or 40 people in the VIP section that were either rock stars, band managers, or record label execs.
That is
Butthole Surfers.
Crazy. So the night that gets the Butthole Surfers signed to Capitol Records, Jane's Addiction is watching in the wings. And maybe they were taking notes and asking questions about all the rumors they'd heard about bad behavior. So if your friends are in shock and disgust over Perry's behavior, please, you can now share this story with them for some perspective. And you're welcome that we are giving you that.
Yeah. By the way, I'm glad we did an episode about the Butthole Surfers because, I mean, good God.
Wait, have you ever said butthole so many times in 40 minutes? There was one night.
I really did think it was really cute. The girl that sang that, "I wonder what's inside of your butthole." And I think I probably shared that way too much with people.
Let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. Were you a fan of the Capitol Records by the time they got on Capitol? and the stuff, Pepper, and that stuff that breaks a little more mainstream. You never liked any of it?
Nah, it's garbage.
Yeah, I always thought it was really, really strange.
I hated all of it, yeah.
And Pepper was a weird, I mean, that was a big hit that still shows up on nostalgia playlists and stuff.
Which I think is a stinker. I can't believe that ever got any play on the radio. I don't understand. I guess when you know somebody, you can get some stuff happening.
The 90s, man. The 90s. Yeah. Okay, if you have a question, a story, a observation on a headline you want us to research.
Or a butthole.
Well, you all have those. I've heard. We are thestoryguys@gmail.com is the way you get involved in the show. Remember, you can get involved on Instagram /rockandrollbedtimestories, YouTube. We have studio videos if you want to watch us.
Patreon.
And patreon.com/rockandrollbedtimestories is where you can support the show. That helps us in a lot of ways. We are able to get more folks to the show when you help us fund it, which is very nice. Until next time, Murdoch, what should people keep doing?
Keep telling stories.
Rock and Roll Bedtime Stories is a Story Guys production. The show is produced and edited by Brian Eichenberger. Get more stories, hear more podcasts, and book the guys for your conference or house party at wearethestoryguys.com. Copyright Boy Have We Got Stories Productions. All rights reserved.